Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
Hello and welcome to Your Booked. I'm Daisy Buchanan, your friendly neighbourhood book inspector, and I'm here to investigate some of our favourite writers and readers for spine-chilling crimes against literature, or rather, spine-bending crimes against literature. I want to find out about the classics they claim to have read when they only watch the movie, the unpaid library fines they've stacked up, and the scandalous stories they like to read when they don't think anyone is watching. My guest this week is the writer and broadcaster and my friend, Dolly Alderton. Many people are familiar with Dolly from her Sunday Times dating column, where she shared a page with the writer Cosmo Landisman and talked about the vagaries of looking for love and being a romantic in a Tinder era and dealing with London's dating scene. Dolly's Sunday Times bestseller, Everything I Know About Love, has been hugely successful and it's touched readers everywhere. It's an incredibly warm, funny and often heartbreaking book about love and loss and friendship. Dolly is able to write about comedy and tragedy with great verve. This episode was recorded at Dolly's fabulous North London flat, where she showed us that not only does she have a very interesting taste in books, she has a great collection of soft furnishings. We talked about the joy of sex, the joy of giving books as presents, and Rod Stewart, where he likes to put his hands, and why you need to be very careful about your trousers when he's around. Dolly, can you tell me about the first book you read that you knew you really weren't supposed to be reading?
The Joy of Sex.
Oh, wow!
Yeah. And I think that The Joy of Sex is the reason why I like men with such big beards who look like they're straight out of a 70s porn film. That's like my type is 70s porn star. And I think it must have been because the first understanding of my own sexuality and male sexuality was reading that book. And I was incredibly young, so that must have left an imprint on my brain.
So where did you get it? Did your parents have it?
My mum had it, yeah. My mum's vibe is very The Joy of Sex. God love her.
Did she have it? Was it under her bed? Did you have to wait till she was out and sneak it?
No, I remember... I've never actually talked to her about this. I remember seeing it on... at the top of her bookshelf. And I remember waiting until I would get really excited if she ever left their house, because I would climb up and go find it and then pull through it. And it was illustrations. And then I found there were actual photos as well, sort of close-up anatomy.
So was there penetration in
the Yeah, sex? Yeah, there was. And it was... I was completely fascinated by it. I think I had that thing that... I would have been really young when I read it. And I think I had that thing that I definitely knew I shouldn't have been reading it. I felt very shameful and embarrassed that I was reading it.
So do you know how old you were, roughly? Were you
probably
at school?
About 8 or 9, yeah. And then I remember feeling... I think most people I know had this feeling when they first started reading about the kind of machinations of the physical side of sex, that I felt... really excited and intrigued and exhilarated and incredibly scared as well. It felt very grown up and kind of grotesque, but I just could, and I carried on sort of going and dipping into it and reading the whole thing up until I was probably about 14.
Other than the very hissy men, are there any bits of prose or text that you remember? Is there anything that came up in The Joy of Sex where you thought like, oh, I'll be prepared for that when that happens in adult life and you're still waiting for it to emerge?
I remember, I mean, pubic hair is just so much a part of The Joy of Sex. And I remember reading about pubic hair and smells. And it's very 70s, obviously, the way that it's written. So I remember learning in it that everyone has their own scent and that's completely normal. I mean, to be honest, it's a very, like, sex-positive book to be read. It's, you know, it's all about connection and intimacy. So maybe my mum left it out for me to read, sort of so she didn't have to do the job. Because it's better. I mean, I would so prefer a kid to learn about sex through, like, hirsute, you know, people from the 70s, like, making love in a very, like, tender and honest way, and long passages about how it's totally normal for everyone's genitals and pubic hair and smells to be completely different, rather than watching, you know, you porn. But the other one that I remember reading, which I'm sure every single millennial woman will say this who's a guest on this podcast, was Forever by Judy Blume. Did you read that? Yeah. Did you read
was
that when
Ralph?
You were young? Ralph was the name of his penis, yeah.
I did. Well, I remember knowing about it and hearing, you know, the legend of Forever and reading all of the Judy Blume first, because I could never find it in the library. And I was too embarrassed to ask. Yeah. It's always out. And I thought, as soon as I went up and said, have you got Forever? It was tantamount to going and saying, hello, I'm a pervert. What have you got for me?
Yeah. And it's... because I remember that pre-Forever, I remember the Judy Blume books being really quite tame. So I think it was dog-eared and it was passed around our year. But I remember a line in that so clearly. The parlance I would have used at the time I would have read it would have been she was being a bit frigid. And I remember it said she wasn't having sex with him, but she was doing sort of the everything but sex, and they were kind of discovering each other, and she said she put on a pair of bikini bottoms and they got into bed and he rubbed Ralph up against her bikini bottoms, and she said it felt really hot and really nice. And yeah, it really stuck with me. I think because it's shameless, as in she didn't feel shameful about it, which, you know, children when they're discovering their sexuality, and teenagers when they're discovering their sexuality, feel such a weight of embarrassment and perversion around it. I think to have read that so boldly, that this thing happened and it felt nice, I think felt quite radical for me as a kind of 12 or 13 year old.
What was the last sexy book you read?
I found I Love Dick pretty hot.
Ah, excellent, because I saw that on your shelf.
Yeah.
And I was going to do a sort of schlocky, do you love dick, Dolly Olson?
The reason I found that so sexy, I think, is because it's kind of grotesque. It's a book, it's written by Chris Kraus, who's an artist, and it's like an epistolary, I never know how to say that word, epistolary.
But you did it. Just fine.
Of her writing these letters to a man who she forms this obsessive attachment to. It's kind of a game that her husband gets in on. And she's just burning up with desire for him. And I don't know why I found it such a turn on reading it. I think it's because her sexuality in it is so uncensored and unguarded. It's kind of, yeah, grotesque, and it's extreme, and it's obsessive, and it's graphic, and quite claustrophobic. And I think that turned me on because it's, you just don't really see female sexuality uninterrupted in that way. I just think that kind of grittiness of sexual desire, of a woman's sexuality being kind of animalistic and unboundaried. I just didn't realise until I read that book that you just don't really hear women talking about their sexuality in that way.
On the subject of sexy hunting women and literature and appetite, I want to ask you about a book I have just seen on your dining table, Women Who Read Are Dangerous, edited by, the foreword's by Karen Joy Fowler. I don't know. Is it? Tell me about this book.
So I literally, my mum sent this to me 2 days ago. God love her, and she's written in the front to my favourite dangerous woman with love, mum. My mum's a real bookworm, and she had the French version of this book, which I mean I can't guess. Les femmes.
Les femmes.
Qui écrit?
Dangereux. there we go, doll boy.
I would like to apologise to the French.
So yeah, that's how she found out the book. And it's basically It's paintings of women reading and kind of analysis of women, images of women reading in history and in art and popular culture, and kind of analysis on it. I mean, I've literally just got a couple of days ago, so I cannot wait to get stuck into it. There's something about the there's something hot about watching anyone read, I think. You know, there's something about watching someone be that absorbed in a world that I think is very beguiling.
It's so solitary and so intimate. And when you see someone reading in public, it really does feel like you're walking in on them.
Totally, yeah.
Would you ever admit to reading a book in a public place in the hope that somebody would walk by and think, oh, it's really hot that she's reading that clever book?
Yeah, 100%. I used to do that with The New Yorker.
Ah.
So I'd always, like everyone who has subscribed to The New Yorker, I never read it.
The tyranny of it.
But apparently, David Mamet, I was listening to him on WTF the other day, and he's so funny, and he was talking about The New Yorker, and he's like, people say they love the poetry pages of The New Yorker, and I've never met someone who can say one line from a poem that they've read in the poetry pages of The New Yorker. And actually, David Remnick said the tyranny of The New Yorker thing, the pressure to read all of The New Yorker from cover to cover, is totally self-imposed. And he's like, I'd never, as the editor, expect anyone to read The New Yorker from cover and cover.
They
should. It is madness, and they should. But there is this weird pressure of it, which means you don't read any of it.
I'm going to head over to my first shelf.
Oh, yeah. The Story of O. That's a sexy book.
Ah, that is a sexy book. A very spanky book.
That's a spanky book, and that was given to me by a boy who I wrote about in my book called Hector. In my memoir, I wrote about him, and he said, I don't know how I can phrase this without it getting too X-rated. There were things detailed in this book that he would like me to know about. So I feel very, it's weird. There's something so, it's like quite an intimate act, isn't it, when you give someone a book. It's the same as when you give someone a piece of music, because what you know is that your face in yourself is going to hang in their head as they listen to that song. So it's quite a manipulative thing to do, I think. And giving me The Story of O, which is a story of someone discovering S&M.
What is the best book you've ever given and the best book you've ever received?
You know, there are certain books that I give now almost like emotional prescription, that I know you do the same. So there's a book called should I remove my plants? I've got these long hanging plants, which isn't conducive to this podcast. Over my bookshelf.
See, I was really hoping that you had the all the Mills and Boone were hidden behind the plants.
No.
Not, you know. Mills and Boone is great. No judgment.
There's a book somewhere up there called Good Girls Do Swallow. Good Girls Do Swallow, I think, is the only book I can say probably saved my life. And that was given to me by Alex, my friend Alex. And she, I had had massive problems with body image and with eating for about 2 years. And she gave it to me. It's by an Australian writer called Rachel Oakes Ash. And it's about her journey with bulimia and anorexia and recovery. And I'd been on a kind of journey of recovery until I read that book. It didn't really, you know, save my life. That's me being dramatic. But it definitely was on the last page. I remember putting it down and thinking, okay, I'm going to start a kind of different existence from tomorrow. So anyone here I know who's struggling with body stuff, I'll send them that, which is sadly a lot of women I know and love. So that's a book that I give out a lot. The same with Reasons to Stay Alive by Matt Haig. That's a book, here it is. That's a book about his struggles with anxiety and depression. And oh my God, that's so funny. I've written here, August 2015 in the front, darling. So I obviously was going to give this to someone who needed it in August 2015 and then decided, fuck it, I want to keep it for myself. So darling,
maybe it's a note to you,
maybe that's the sort of fey whimsical thing that I would do. But yeah, anyone struggling with depression or anxiety, I always give them that book. And another one is Delight.
Yes, we must talk about Delight because I'm sure listeners will be very familiar with Dolly Mail, your enormously successful newsletter, and that there was a Dolly Mail dedicated to Delight by J.B. Priestley. Can you tell us about that book and what it is?
It's so he wrote it after the Second World War in a time where understandably, here it is, in a time where understandably people were feeling a bit gloomy. So I think he
bummer war.
I think he wrote it to kind of cheer national spirits. And it's just the, oh my God, this is another awful thing that I do. So when I lived with girls, which was about 5 years, I'm so okay with people taking and sharing everything. I honestly would never get upset if someone ruined a dress of mine, if they broke the heels in my shoes, if they used the last bit of my Charlotte Tilbury moisturiser. I don't care. I am fucking psycho about people taking my books. So in the front of every single book, I wrote my initials like an assassin. Who does that? That's so weird.
So what we're seeing, this is your version of like putting your name on each egg in the fridge.
I don't know why. Do you know why? I know why I'm like this. Because if you look at the pages of this book, I steal other people's ideas a lot for my writing, and I quote other writers a lot in my writing.
So as the official book inspector, I want to step in and talk about how much Dolly Hannah Alderton has damaged this book. All of the pages are folded down.
But do you know what? I have, if you look at any of these books that I love, it's constant folded pages, and it's because I often will go back to the book and think of that page that I remembered that we hold with us and use it shamelessly for a piece or for a story or whatever. So I think because I do that with books, it means that I have these like quite weird relationships with the hard copy itself. So I don't like the idea of people taking them, because for me there's been like a very definite like footprint in there of my own. So I don't like people taking it.
It's a bit like they're sort of taking, you know, volume M to O of your encyclopedias.
Exactly. So, but yeah, no, Delight is beautiful, and it's just him kind of pontificating and contemplating the incidental small things of life that brings him delight and joy. Let me find a nice extract.
I know my favourite in Delight is Cozy Planning, where he extols the virtues of getting a gang together and just saying, oh, won't it be lovely when we do this? And I always think about that when I'm having a dinner party. Because what were your own delights? I know you've written about them.
Yes.
Was cigarettes one of them?
I can't remember. So I read this book by J.B. Priestley, and I was so moved by it, and I loved the idea of it so much. It's just so charming. And that's my favourite kind of writing, actually, I've realised more and more. And that's my favourite, and this is why I'm such an unbelievably shit and uncommissionable journalist, is that my favourite...
I think anyone listening would agree with that.
But my favourite thing to write about, you know, I pitched a piece to the New Statesman today being like, the joy of blossom. Surprisingly, they didn't go for it. But I think my favourite... This is why I love Indian Night as a writer so much, is that kind of journalism which is taking the quotidian and elevating it in this kind of forensic, detailed academic way of why do I love that? Why does it make me so happy? And a celebration. So after I read this book, I went and found that there was another brilliant collection that was an updated version called Modern Delight, which is really hard to find, actually. You can buy it secondhand on Amazon. And it's people like, it's the great and the good of, you know, British media. It's Nick Hornby and Jeremy Paxman, Stephen Fry, Bill Nighy, Michael Palin, Indian Night.
Oh, we have to find out what Jeremy Paxman's delight is. I'm longing to hear this. Is it shouting? Correcting people?
And they all write about something that brings them delight. I actually know something that brings Jeremy Paxman delight, because I was sat next to him at a lunch the other couple of months ago.
Ooh.
And it was for the Sotheby's... I mean, this is a shamelessly name-droppy story, but it's so good, I have to say it. It was the Sotheby's Erotica sale lunch.
Wow!
Yeah, we got quite drunk at lunch, and then we wandered around looking at everything, and he was absolutely appalled that there was no pubic hair.
Ah!
So I wonder
everything comes back to pubic hair. The joy of sex is probably
exactly
being Jeremy Paxman.
Was
delight.
His essay on the joy of pubic hair? What was it on?
Sadly not. It's on Frogspawn.
Nature's pubic hair.
What does he say about Frogspawn?
The first inkling usually comes in February or March when you suddenly notice the generally stagnant surface of the pond has started to explode in a welter of bubbles. I suspect he enjoys writing about Frogspawn more than the Frogspawn.
Yes, I imagine so. Oh, here we go. This is probably, I think, family silliness, domestic clowning.
Ah, how lovely. Do you want to read a bit from it?
Yeah. Family silly. Sorry. So this is J.B. Priestley's book, Delight, which inspired Modern Delight, and it's his...
It contains no Frogspawn, to the best of our knowledge.
So this is every chapter is a chapter of something that brings him joy. Family silliness, domestic clowning. This cannot be described in any detail, and it would be disastrous to quote even the best of the jokes. A fairly large family is necessary, but nobody concerned need have any great sense of humour. You start with any bit of nonsense, usually at the dining table, and then everybody adds shaggy pieces of their own until the whole table is roaring and screaming and the scarlet cheeks of the younger children are wet with tears of laughter. To a sensitive outsider, the scene would probably bring no delight at all, and indeed would probably seem repulsive. But then it is not meant for outsiders, sensitive or otherwise. You have to be thoroughly in it and of it to appreciate its quality. Somewhere below this rowdy monkey business are deep hidden roots, and somewhere above it are invisible blossoms. My God, that's the most beautiful line. A collective personality springs into being sometime during the slapstick. Without a happy togetherness, the little farce would never begin. And it is scenes like these, without dignity, real wit or beauty, made up of screeching and bellowing and fourth-rate jokes about treacle puddings or castor oil, that a man who feels his life ebbing out may recall with an anguish of regret and tenderness, remembering as if it were a lost bright kingdom, the family all at home and being silly. Isn't that perfect?
That last bit just wins you, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Oh, gosh, it's astonishing.
And it really gets to give me goosebumps.
I'm overcome, so I need to bring it back with some more silliness. Dolly, I have in my hand.
I know, this
Rod Stewart's autobiography.
This is my most incriminating.
This looks like the most read of all your books.
Okay, now, this is one of my favourite books of all time. And I know people think I'm being silly when I say, look how many turned over pages I have here. There's a brilliant, brilliant...
Are you sure this isn't the last sexy book you read?
Do you know what? I think I've read this about 5 times. It's such... I know this... I'm a massive Rod Stewart fan. The Faces is one of my favourite bands. So I know that I have, like, a bit of a personal and emotional and perhaps sexual investment in this in a way that most normal human beings wouldn't. But it really is an amazing rock memoir. I think it's the best rock memoir I've ever read, actually. And he's... a sort of delicious mix of incredibly self-aware, actually, and very eager to laugh at himself, as well as being astonishingly boastful and incredibly egotistical. So it's like it's just like the most compulsive thing.
To jump in, I do the only Rod Stewart book I know is from Sherry Currie from The Runaways. In her autobiography, she writes about meeting Rod Stewart at a party, and I think she must have been about 17, and she offers him cocaine, and he is tearfully grateful and says, no one ever offers me, everybody always just takes mine.
Which is why he's such a tight bastard. Understandably, poor Rod. There's just one bit that I'd love to read you that is him talking about putting his hands down a girl's pants.
Oh, so we've progressed from Forever and the Ralph bikini rubbing. We're going in.
Did I? It's...
Check the index.
That's a good idea.
I don't think it'll have hands down.
Do you know, I can't find the paragraph, but there's this wonderful bit where he's talking about his childhood. And he's a North London boy as well, which is probably another reason why I love him. And he grew up in... kind of the archway end of Highgate, above a sweet shop in a very, very modest little flat with his family. His dad owned the sweet shop. And he said when he was a teenager, he used to meet girls normally down on Eel Pie Island, and then he would take them back through East Finchley. So he'd walk through the super posh end of Highgate through Bishop's Road, which is like Millionaire's Row. And he said he would stand outside the most enormous house and he would say, I would love to invite you in, but, you know, Dad's got the diplomat of whatever to stay tonight, so I probably shouldn't, but next time we'd love to. And he describes an incident, and then he describes an incident where he kissed a girl, and he immediately, in one of these moments, in the kind of midnight, in the darkness of Bishop's Road, and he put his hands down her pants, and she said, tits first, please. And I think he had a bit of a fumble, and then he put his hand down her pants, and then he said I mean, this is why I love him, he's so disgusting. He said he then walked back to Archway to the sweet shop he lived above, and he didn't wash his hands for a fortnight.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
We'll be back to the books in a bit, but I'd like to talk about my steal of the week, a book so brilliant that it's worth its weight in diamonds, and buying it for the cover price is a bit like breaking the law. This week's steal of the week is My Year of Rest and Relaxation by Atessa Moshfegh. This was published by Vintage a few years ago, and I'd heard a lot about this book and I was really excited about reading it because the heroine is living my ultimate fantasy life, where she drugs herself and hibernates for a year and makes a project out of it with the purpose of escaping the trivial and annoying parts of her life and waking up reborn. I think this book has really polarised people. A lot of people find the heroine, who is never named, quite tricky in her privilege and her whininess, but it's really, really darkly funny. It's a really great social satire. Moshfegh is very, very sharp on, I think, women in their 20s at their best and worst, and also the people they date and the lives they live. So that's My Year of Rest and Relaxation by Atessa Moshfegh, published by Vintage and available everywhere now. Now, back to the interrogation room for some more shocking literary misdemeanours. How do you feel about taking this into the bedroom?
These are a selection. So the bedroom is a selection of kind of my favourite books that I refer to a lot, including How to Improve Your Man in Bed by Lynn Barber, and books that I'm kind of desperate to read as well.
So I wanted to ask you about the Woody Allen book, because that's a tricky area.
So obviously we're in dangerous territory talking about this. I think it's okay to still love this book and be very aware with my eyes open that Woody Allen is probably an abuser. I think, you know, when you read something like this book was written when, in the 60s sometime. But I think a lot of people have this with Woody Allen's books and films, especially those early ones, that it kind of formed a lot of who I was, I think, and how I thought about men and women, and certainly a lot about my sense of humour. So for that to be sort of cast in the fire alongside Woody Allen's reputation, which Woody Allen's reputation should be, I think you can keep the books and the art out of the fire, you know, and see them as separate entities. And then I listened to Lena Dunham on the WTF podcast with Mark Maron, and she said this thing that I think is very true. Her parents are artists, and her parents do incredibly graphic sexual art. And she said, I had to grow up in a world where I'm taught that obviously art is like an extension of your consciousness, but it isn't evidence of your morality. And I have to say, I agree with that. And I hadn't thought of it like that, but she said, what we should be taking seriously and what should be making us feel disturbed are the allegations of the abused. What we shouldn't be doing is going back through the work he created and combing through to try and find evidence through characters or dialogue or plot that he was a bad man. And I sort of agree with her. And look, it is a really complicated thing. It's something I've had to think about a lot, as Dale knows, because I've already bored him senseless when I came around to your house for dinner once. My favourite musician is John Martin. And one of the most difficult things about loving John Martin has been confronting the fact that he was a horrible, horrible man. And I went on such a journey to try and find out who he was, and I was so desperate to have evidence that he wasn't. People who knew him kept saying to me, he was a wife beater, he was, you know, abused to his family, he was, and it got to a point where my writing partner and I, Lauren, love him so much, we went to this weird tribute festival in the Yorkshire Dales a couple of years ago and had this whole weekend with his friends and family. And it was a really disturbing and sad time because we were given concrete evidence that this person whose music has been so tender and taught us so much about love and intimacy was definitely a bad person. And I think, you know, I talk about this a lot, but bad person really is the wrong word, because bad people and good people don't exist. I think it's like makes us feel so much safer and so much more in control of the world if we're like, okay, Woody Allen is a bad man, John Marston is a bad man, they abuse young women, they hit their wives, or, you know, Woody Allen didn't, but John Marston allegedly did, therefore their work is defunct, none of it means anything, all the emotion is fake, they haven't felt anything, they're psychopaths, they don't know how to connect to other humans. The truth is, like, we've all met people who feel incredibly deeply and who are exceptionally big-hearted and who can really plummet to the depths of human and emotional experience and are empathizers in their own way, who also treat people really badly because humans are really complicated, morality is really complicated, as is the suffering that makes us and the suffering we inflict. So this is a long way of me being like, don't have a go at me about having bloody without feathers on the shelf.
Let's think of something more cheerful on the bookshelf. Now, I really want to ask you about, firstly, as the book inspector, you have diaries by your bed, and they're not even your diaries, Dolly, I'm horrified. They are Tina Brown's diaries.
Yes.
She did submit them for publication. And Tina Brown was your guest on your podcast, The High Low.
Yes, she was.
I believe. What was that experience like? Was she as you expected?
Yeah, she was amazing. She's have you read the Tina Brown diaries?
I've not. I have them.
Oh, you've
not
read them yet.
I got
love
them for
it.
Christmas, which Christmas 2017. It's whenever this goes out, we'll know that was some time ago.
It will swallow you up, though. It will totally swallow you up for about 3 days. And actually, it's the tone of it has. I don't know if you find this, but whatever I'm reading at the time, I find myself regurgitating tonally in my writing. So it's the same with, I've noticed, whatever man I'm in love with, I'll only fancy men that look like that guy. So like when I was with a guy who was like beardy and shorter than me, a bit chubby, everywhere I went I suddenly started forming these crushes on that man. I do exactly the same with books. When I'm in a relationship with a book, I feel the tone of that writer kind of slipping into everything that I write. And Tina Brown has such a like strong tone in this book. It's kind of like very magazine-y the way that she writes it, these diary entries, and every entry kind of begins with wowza. Big day in the office, and it's like name dropping a few people. Trump said this, blah blah blah. Then it mentions a party that she went to, and always a seating plan of who she sat next to. And then she'll reference the go-go 80s or the new 90s. And then the last question is always with a kind of heavy-handed jeopardy, but will it be a cover? And Helen Nianius, who's a journalist who also read it very quickly, said that she started having the thoughts in the voice of Tina Brown's diary entries because the tone was so warped and so strong. And she now will sometimes just send me messages saying, I've taken on some young Turks who can really spin a yarn about the go-go 80s. But will it be a cover? So yeah, you'll find yourself slipping into that. But
please,
it's amazing.
Can we form a band called the Go-Go 80s and only do covers?
That's a great idea. But yeah, it's a compulsive book. If you work in magazines as well, I mean, it's particularly compulsive, so you will love it, Daisy.
How do you feel about, as a writer and having a voice, and I think that most people will agree, you know, they know that it's you. You can read a Dolly paragraph and you don't have to have your byline. You know, you're like Beyonce, you know that's
you. Love
you. And you're at the Super Bowl. Do you like feeling, you know, a bit like a sort of a chameleon, or, you know, a writer that is a reader, that there is a bit of you that is the sum of everything you've read and everything you've been? Or do you find it really hard when Tina Brown's voice turns up?
Do you know,
I'm
what?
Writing about Blossom, Tina Brown. Go,
you know,
Blossom.
Do you know what? It doesn't worry me at all. I feel grateful for it. I've always felt, Katna Moran put it so perfectly, didn't she, that everyone's a patchwork of their own references. And I've always loved that idea that all these different albums and writers and friends and articles and films all kind of, like osmosis, get into the kind of seabed of my consciousness, and then I kind of permeate it through my writing. I love that. I know I'm definitely made up of lots of different people who've influenced me. I tell you what though, it does panic me, because there have been times I'm so quick to absorb things that people have said that there have been moments in my life where I very nearly rewrote a Derek Walcott poem in my book, which is awful. But there have been moments where I've read articles that I've written in retrospect, and I've been like, oh no, you've literally just copied something from a Bill Bryson book. And I have no idea at the time. And that's a writer's biggest fear, isn't it? Is inauthenticity or stealing other people's work and not crediting them. And I'm sure I have done it without realising. And I remember going back through one of my drafts of Everything I Know About Love and thinking, God, that is beautiful. The kind of the pace of that. And it almost reads like poetry. Maybe it is poetry. Oh, hang on. And I realised I just lifted a line from a Derek Walcott poem, and I had somehow convinced myself that it was my own. Thank God I realised it. So no, it panics me rather than anything. I'm really conscious. If I ever write anything that I think is really good, I really sit and make sure that it's not because I haven't stolen it from someone, and that's why it's good. And normally I have stolen it from someone.
Do you write a particular place? Do you feel like you have to kind of have a certain setting? Or do you, as a journalist, write wherever you can in a state of panic, as I do?
Well, you're amazing. I remember you and I sitting once in a Shoreditch house, and it was so loud. And
oh God, people are going to hate us. Can we take that bit out?
I remember us sitting in a cafe in Shoreditch once, and it was so loud.
Crystal Palace.
And down in Penge. And you wrote the most exquisite piece for me about making your own luck for the Dolly Mail. And he wrote it in about 45 minutes. And I remember watching, it was like a magician. Because for me, I have to have total silence. I'm a massive procrastinator. I normally write best on the sofa, which I know isn't good. It should probably be at a table, but I normally write best at the sofa. But I've only realised recently when I talk to people that the way I write stuff is quite weird. So I have never, ever in my life ever written anything chronologically. What happens normally, be it for a piece or a chapter, or actually with scripts, I write scripts more chronologically, but that's more because of the format and the layout of it. It's kind of, it's easier to, rather than jumping around. But with articles, certainly, and with chapters of my book, I'll always start with something really, I mean, it's a very childish way to write. I'll start with something really juicy. So it's normally the top line that I pitched to someone. So it's either the best joke in it, the best scene in it or story in it, or the best revelation or epiphany in it, and I'll write that first. And then normally I write the ending, so that's normally about in the middle. Then normally I write the endings are really important to me, so I'll write the ending always before the beginning. I normally write the beginning last, actually. And then I will always write like a collage with these kind of random separate paragraphs. And then the most boring bit of writing for me is normally the last hour, which is when I will bring it together as some sort of cohesive thing. But I've never written anything chronologically. It's quite a stressful way to write, actually. Yeah. I don't know why I do it. I can't do it any other way.
If there was any book in the building that you could cross out the name of the author and write by Dolly Alderton on it,
oh,
what
would
it
be? That's a good question. Probably at the moment, the one that I'm reading, which is on my bedside shelf. Sorry to shimmy you around. I'm so moved by this. It's To Throw Away Unopened by Viv Albertine.
So you would have had to have been in the slits.
I'd have had to have been in the slits. I would have had to have a much more interesting and dramatic and traumatic life, which I would not fetishise, because it doesn't sound like it's been easy for Viv Albertine. But I think Viv Albertine on patriarchal conditioning and feminism, I think she might be my favourite writer in the world on those subjects. And she writes in such an unselfconscious way, and she's such a brave writer. There's a line in her first memoir called clothes, music, boys, that I always use now, and credit her, because I think it's such a good way of understanding internalized misogyny, where she said, the patriarchy is an army that has outposts in your head.
Ooh.
Doesn't that just sum it
up
perfectly?
Absolutely is. I think about that a lot.
Yeah. Yeah, I love her writing so much. And look, I've already got lots of turned down pages in there. Yeah.
Would you write another memoir?
I don't think I would, because I've simply just used up all my stories, I think. I don't know, maybe in the future I would. I mean,
not next year.
Yeah, maybe way off in the future I would. I love the idea of being like a Diana Athill and just writing sort of memoir after memoir after memoir. But I think, as you well know, having written a memoir, I think at the moment you feel so, and this, I don't want this to sound like martyry or sacrificial or like, you know, people were all banging down my door for many years asking for the story of my very boring life. You know, I very much chose to put that story out there. But apparently it's very normal that in the months after it's published, I think you do feel quite exposed suddenly. It does feel like you've laid quite a lot bare. And I don't know if I'd be in a massive rush to do that again.
Well, on that very conclusive note, how could we, on that note, Jolly, it has been an absolute pleasure. Thank you so much.
Thank you for coming and snooping. You can come and snoop anytime you like.
You are officially booked.
I love this podcast.
I've never done that before.
That was so fun. You are officially booked. You've made the catchphrase.
Huge thanks to our guest Dolly for cooperating with the authorities. I can now say that her bookshelves are a safe place for decent citizens to be. Dolly's book, Everything I Know About Love, is out now, published by Fig Tree. Thanks so much for listening and helping me in my efforts to keep our guests on the straight and narrow and out of Reading Jail. You can find a list of all the books mentioned on today's show at acast.com/booked. Email us and ask us questions about the show at whybooked@gmail.com. That's the letter Y, then booked@gmail. Find me on Twitter. I'm @notrollergirl. And on Instagram, I'm @thedaisyb. That's B as in the insect. Join me next time for more petty page-based crimes and shelf actualization. If you liked it, please rate the podcast, review it, subscribe it, and spread the word. This helps others to find the podcast and keeps our bookshops and libraries safe. This episode was produced by Dale Shaw. I'm Daisy Buchanan. Don't have nightmares. Do read well.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Late bloomers tend to have more curiosity. They tend to have more resilience.
There are stories and mythology that this country has woven around Black men.
This is the cavalry, right? These are the leaders, the hometown heroes and local leaders. And we are.
It's a survival mechanism to just be like wary of police.
What if everything we've been taught is just all wrong?
What's worth more than this fear right now?
And that rising after failure is part of the glory of being a human being.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.